Welcome to another edition of Decentralizing AI. And we have a special guest today, Ciro. Really excited to have you on the show.
I'm excited to be here. I love the studio. It's really nice. Thank you for the invite.
Yeah, glad to hear that.
Yeah, I mean, you gave an incredible talk last week that I saw. And I'm, just so thrilled to have you here and pick your brain about some stuff.
I've been trying to public speak whenever I can. I think it's very useful. You develop aura farming. You know, you farm this aura and it makes it easier to keep going into the future. And that's why I really like podcasting. I have my own podcast and I love that you guys are taking this initiative. It's pretty cool.
Thank you. Yeah, definitely expect you to get a big aura boost today. So that should work out.
Yeah. Also, we're pretty early ourselves in our podcast journey. So
yeah,
this is a real treat. I think, you're like our third guest ever. And I think this is podcast like 7 or so?
Something like that. Yeah. Still in an embryonic form.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it doesn't take much. I think just a few like practice runs and it becomes easy to speak in public. It's really not that hard. People feel I think it's in America, it's reported as the number one fear is public speaking, which is very strange to me.
Yeah, it's like above death, right?
I believe so. Yeah, it's at the very, very top. So it takes a little getting used to, but once you get rolling with it, it's a lot of fun. So
yeah. So would you like to introduce yourself and give a little background? Or?
Sure. So I go by Ciro online. My name is Sharif. I've been working in AI for the last almost 3 years now. I started working with a project called Eliza OS. This was a few years ago. It was like Twitter bots. You attach like an AI model to it and you can basically talk to it on Twitter and it can do stuff for you, right? It was a very early form of agents. That was what moved me over. Before that, I was working in crypto for, I think, 3 years, give or take. I was a grantee at the Ethereum Foundation. I did some applied research for ZK proofs. This was like ZK loans at the time and these eSIMs. So it was Ethereum SIM. You can basically go on the blockchain, send money to an address, and you could download a binary, and it basically lets you use the internet from anywhere in the world.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, it was like fully open source. There's a lot of cool stuff happening in crypto. So I moved over to AI, started with Eliza. At this point, I am working on a whole bunch of projects, one of them being XO. This is a way to take a few computers that you have at home, like MacBooks, Macs, and cluster them together so you can run larger and larger models. That's one of the things that we do. Another one is local.ai, where we took all the most popular models that fit on consumer hardware. We benchmarked them and we benchmarked all of their compressions so that we can try to figure out like what are the best forms of compression. What are the best models that you can run on certain hardware? How fast will it run? Because that information was missing off the internet. I also do my own recordings and podcasts and videos and stuff. That's pretty fun.
Awesome. Yeah, this is a total treat. I'm honestly so excited. I have so many things I want to ask you, but partly just what you've been talking about with the benchmarking. I cannot tell you how many hours I spent over the last year and a half trying to answer those questions. You are completely correct. It is not on the internet. I've asked every AI model out there. I've even done like shopping mode in ChatGPT, deep research with every agent. I'm like, all right, I have like roughly this budget. Maybe I have a few $1,000 and I want to get a machine that can run private AI and like, which model should I use? And you know, the other thing is like, there's a lot of like these sales or like almost gimmicky ads you'll see on Instagram or other social media sites that are advertising these like high tops machines. Mm-hmm. But actually that's very misleading. You can have very high tops and very low memory bandwidth and you will be crawling with tokens per second. So anyway, just all that to say, it is not the easiest thing at all to be able to figure out without this. So I'm honestly local.ai. I even tried to use it. I guess, is it available for the public yet?
So or? I can give you a link to the demo that we currently have. The reason it's not public is we want to make sure all the data is complete and correct.
Okay.
And we don't like, because we don't want to like put data out there that is incorrect, which is part of like the difficulty. We can actually get into the difficulty there, but I just wanted to ask, like, have you looked into this at all? Is this something that's crossed your mind?
Which specifically?
The local AI stuff, like the benchmarking and finding models and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's been a big focus of the product I'm working on, Vora. And so we're going to be selling consumer hardware for local inference based on the AMD Strix Halo platform. Mm-hmm. So I do a ton of benchmarking. I've created this kind of virtual benchmarking lab. So it, you know, scans for the latest models, pulls them down, runs the suite of benchmarks and evals to test it for tool calling and the different kind of metrics we want for the product we're making. So yeah, I've been really deep down that rabbit hole looking at different quantizations, playing with multi-token prediction, looking at, you know, using Vulkan versus RockM, you know, llama.cpp, all these different things. And yeah, it's, you know, there's been instances where I will, you know, be working on, I actually had a PR merged to llama.cpp just because I was working on some benchmarking and it was a template error. And, you know, a lot of times I'll just find myself hitting numbers that aren't even published online yet because it is just so experimental and early right now. But yeah, I have a lot of fun with that stuff.
Yeah, I would love to go into the challenges a little bit because I think it makes it clear like why this is not. And like, so when I first started getting into this, I had, I think, a budget of 10K and I wanted to buy like hardware. It didn't matter what hardware it was, but I just wanted to run models at home. This was when Cursor switched from their like basically all you can eat to having to pay per token. And I just saw my costs continuing to skyrocket. Like at this point, I'm paying $1,200 in different subs. But if I were paying token prices, I would be spending maybe $40,000 a month because right. All of them, like they incentivize the use right now. Like this was also happening in crypto. So companies would come in and they would like give out these, I forgot what they're called, like airdrops. They would do these airdrops and like that would incentivize people to use the products and like create the market around certain companies and projects. So this is what the companies are doing now with tokens, funny enough.
Interesting, yeah.
But when you want to switch over to local, the problem you're going to have is that there's just so much jargon, like GGUF, AWQ, BF16, whatever. Like there's so many different like little codes that you go on Hugging Face and you have to like read through, and every type of hardware actually has like its own pros and cons. So there's no like advice that would fit onto everything. So all the advice would have to be tailored towards the person's situation. Then if you want to ask a model for advice, so this industry is moving very quickly. So every 3 months, like the standards shift and the models, they usually have like a 6 month period where they don't know what's going on, right? It's because they're trained, they're frozen, they're released to the public, and they're usually 6 months behind the release date. So by the time you are asking it a question, it's giving you data from like a year ago. Even if you tell it search the web and stuff, like imagine you ask somebody to search the web, but they don't really know that Qwen 3.6.25b27b is out. So it's gonna have to like go and llama models, right? And it's gonna, because that's what it knows. That's the predominant data and it's pre-training. So
it's like even when it forms the search queries to go out and look. Mm-hmm. And I still find models even today that are like surprised. They're like, mm-hmm. Oh, that is true.
Yeah.
Because they have this 6 month, you know, prior worldview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I do think if with the right kind of direction with the search queries and having it use like multiple research sub agents at the same time, that can really help get it to have a more comprehensive survey. But you have to be more directive and not just trust the mm-hmm. answer it gives you or the search results it gives back.
Well, and then you're really dependent on like, have other people published on the data that I want? Mm-hmm. And what I just found is there was very little.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Jesse, I'm just curious, of all the stuff you're running, like, are you actively publishing all the little things that you're finding?
No, I think most
people are like that.
I probably should, you know, because there will be times where I'm like, wow, we just, you know, I'm testing this PR with this new feature and I'm getting a certain speed that I haven't seen people publish online yet, or there's a lot of like incorrect information where I'm getting different results than what I'm seeing online. So it's a good reminder that I should probably be doing more to get my results to the surface. And the more people do that in general, like you've been doing, I think that is really important. What's happening in open source AI is so essential to what's going on in the world. And I think we can all play a part in contributing to what is a community effort where we're all working together to make sure that intelligence remains democratized and open and accessible to everyone.
I have to say, like, there's a huge appetite for this. So if you, there's Google search terms, it's a website where you can put in like terms and you can see how many people are searching anything related to that. And so if you look at local AI, open source AI, whatever, home AI, you can see explosions like month over month over month. More and more people are getting interested because one, like the costs are going up. So the incentives are, they're not running dry. I think we still have like 5 more years of this kind of, or maybe like 2 to 5 years of this situation, but it is drying up and basically you're being forced to use certain products. So if you want the free tokens, you have to use Claude Code. And I would say like Claude Code is really not the best harness out there. Like I use it still because ultimately I just want to get things done, right? It's the job that needs to get done, but it's just really not the best thing out there. So there are better solutions, like I would say Droid, Amp, Pi. These are all better harnesses objectively, but their problem is that they don't sell the inference. Like so that they have to go and do the API deals with Anthropic, with OpenAI. OpenAI is much more open about letting you stick your subscription anywhere. I really like that about them. They actually have been pretty consistent. Like, so they say like we want access for everybody. They've been consistent about that, at least from what I've seen. They've given me like 6 months sub just for doing open source. And if you ask them like online and you just share a repo, they'll give you 6 months. As long as it's like a real open source contribution.
Sure. I didn't know that. That's a great thing to know about.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to say before. So the social media landscape right now, it's just flooded with bots and AI and bad data and bad information. So if you spend time like curating, like testing, doing these benchmarks and you publish them, you will get a lot of like traction very quickly because this seems to be like a universal problem for everybody interested in AI.
Yeah. And there's a lot of, you know, I think there's also a lot of open source AI clickbait, you know, where people publish something and they're like, you know, oh, I got GLM 5.2 running on my phone, you know, or like these kinds of exaggerated claims. And then when you like dig under the surface, it's like, okay, but you're getting, you know, one token a second, or there's something about it, you know, or you're running a one bit quant where the quality is like completely crazy. So I think being able to have sources of information that can differentiate between something that's just getting traction on X because it got overhyped and it sounds really cool versus real substantive information. And one of the things along those lines that I've noticed is that people oftentimes don't realize that memory bandwidth is really the key bottleneck oftentimes. You know, you can get a bunch of Mac minis or Mac studios and connect them all together, or get, you know, 128 gigabyte Strix Halo or multiple of them and load these really big models. But because the memory bandwidth isn't there, it's not really usable. It's, you know, some kind of theoretical thing where like, oh yeah, it can run, but you're not really going to use it day to day. And that's where you really see the, where the prices start to skyrocket is the GPUs with the really high memory bandwidth are the most expensive ones. And, you know, I think that's something that isn't well understood by a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have like the amount of memory, that's one thing. Then you have the memory bandwidth, and then you have like the type of memory. So the amount of memory, when you're using these like mixed memory cards like the Strix or the DGX Spark, you have like low decode tokens a second. So if you're using any model, like you usually on Hugging Face, you'll see something like 200B 10A example. So that 10A is like active parameter count. And you can, I'm sure you know this, just in case people. Oh,
no, this is great.
Yeah, yeah. Please go into as much detail as you want here.
There's a few ways to build models. Like, there's two very popular structures that you would use. One is mixture of experts. So you have a model, and let's say it's 200 billion parameters. The model only activates per token. So every token it generates, it only activates 10 billion parameters, right? So 5% of the model is turning on. So you get the same speed decode a second as you would with a 10 billion parameter model, plus some overhead where it's like trying to find the right experts. But you can run large models and you can have them with good performance on things like the Strix Halo. I think I got DeepSeek V4 Flash on the Spark at 33 tokens a second.
Nice.
So that's approaching usable in my opinion. Like, right. You could use it, right? Mm-hmm. GPT 5.3 Codex was running at like 30 to 40 tokens a second.
Oh,
and people,
really?
Yeah, people were calling it slow decks, right? It's like, there's Slopus and slow decks. So, like, you know, Slopus is like sloppy Opus and the very slow GPT models.
I will say I've noticed that, like, whenever I'm running a local model and I get up to like 40, 50 tokens per second or higher, and some models I am, like, I'm running this new one that you got me more interested in last week. I'm getting up to like 70 tokens per second. It feels noticeably faster mm-hmm. than these subscriptions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so which model is that?
So this is the Qwen 3.6, I think 35 billion A3B.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I guess it's like number two on a lot of your benchmarks.
Yeah, yeah. So for consumer hardware, I think that is probably like the overall best model, unless you have NVIDIA hardware, like NVIDIA GPU specifically. That is the best model. Because it's really cheap to run. You can run it on like maybe $250 to $500 of hardware. I've seen this on Twitter. So I know the person, so I trust them. But what they did is they went out, purchased two PlayStation 5s that were like in bad state. They ripped them apart. They take the card out because the card, I think it has 8 gigabytes of memory. I could be wrong. But basically they networked them together. And they have the model running at like 50 tokens a second. And it's for $300 obviously, wow. the effort that goes into like getting it all together is maybe not worth the price at the end of the day if it's taking you like 30 hours. But it's possible, right? So if you're in a third world country, you usually have access to PlayStations, right? It's very common to have a PlayStation. So you have access to like local hardware. If you look at the Spark is... In the US, the price dropped a day ago by $400. It's 4K now. But if you take it to Europe, you add a 30% tariff. You add the American tariff. I forgot how much it is. By the time it's there, it's like $7,000, $8,000.
Wow, just for a DGX Spark? Because that's a unified memory system. Yeah,
and it's higher memory bandwidth than the Strix Halo.
Oh, it is.
By a little bit, not by a lot.
Yeah. Okay. I've really been loving the Gemma 4 26B MOE mm-hmm. model, in particular because they have the QAT, the quantized aware training.
Mm-hmm.
So you get better performance on the 4-bit because they trained it at the lower quant. And then it has the MTP, which I think Qwen 3.6 also has MTP as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, on Strix Halo, I get, you know, about a little bit less than 100 tokens a second.
That's really good for the Strix Halo. I've done, they sent me one, Framework sent me the desktop, 128 gigabytes, and I like did a lot of work on it. It's on my GitHub. I was not able to get those speeds.
Well, so not only that, because we sit next to each other, so I'm like seeing you do all this stuff. And I was, I have this kind of like, pipeline I need to be running that like is really good for batches and it's a little bit like very asynchronous, so I can just throw like I don't need it to be run in order like when you do a conversation,
right.
And because of that I was able to get I don't know like 30 plus instances of it or slots I guess it's called
mm-hmm. right.
And aggregate mm-hmm. across multiple jobs the rate I was getting close to like 265 tokens per second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but for a single stream, it's much, much, much slower.
Yeah, a single stream, it's much lower. It's much more like 100-ish.
Right.
But if you have certain things, like, I don't know, you're doing like a deep research task, you can do a bunch of things in parallel, then you can get even higher.
If I can real quick just say, so there's like a trend, this D-Flash trend. So it's diffusion. Like it's, so there's MTP, which is multi-token prediction, speculative decoding. What this is like you have the large model and then you have a copy that's very small. It shares the same vocabulary and it just predicts a few tokens at a time because it's faster, right? It's much smaller, so it's faster. So it could predict like maybe 20 tokens or something before this one predicts one. So then the larger one samples from the smaller one that's predicting these tokens. And that gives you a speed boost, usually like 1.3x to maybe 2x, like depending on how much you hit. But these diffusion models, it's like maybe 5 to 10x the speed.
Wow.
So there's a diffusion Gemma. 26B,
yeah.
And it runs at like 500, 600 tokens a second on a 6,000. Like obviously, maybe for you, it'll be like 200. I'm really not sure. But that's very interesting. That's super, super interesting to me.
Because in the diffusion Gemma, it outputs like entire blocks mm-hmm. at a time instead of just one token at a time. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting to think about how you might be able to make up with some loss of power with speed, because if the LLM can be running more loops and checking itself,
mm-hmm.
If it runs fast enough, then you know it may not matter as much that it's lower parameter because the speed kind of can compensate a little bit.
Well, and you might be able to break up normally what you might do in like one prompt, if you can break it up into like smaller prompts where some of those prompts are creating like almost constraints or verification checks, and then they're applied to later ones. I think there's probably a lot of stuff to explore there.
Yeah, definitely. So what do you guys think of what's going on with Fable 5? Because, you know, as of this recording, it's still unavailable and, you know, the U.S. government put it under a export ban. Despite the fact that, you know, I thought the safeguards in Fable 5 were completely over the top when I was using it. You know, I if there was the word security anywhere in the context window, it would bump it down. And, you know, I try to switch it back. We're like off on, you know, it'd just be like there was a security review I asked for like earlier on. And I would have to like reset the context window because it would keep bumping me down. Or I heard people were doing just like basic research in biology and it would bump it down. And so I was pretty shocked because I thought, you know, this is way over the top. They should be reducing the safeguards. Yet apparently the U.S. government thought it wasn't restricted enough and put it under this export ban, which feels like a kind of a watershed moment in the history of AI. Like we've gotten really used to this kind of unfettered access. And, you know, every few weeks or every month, we're going to get a new model drop that's more powerful. So do you guys think this is a one-off? Is this a new paradigm? And what do you think the motivations were to put these restrictions on?
I'll let you start.
Yeah, it's it's a good point. I mean, you know, there's a lot of things happening at once, right? Like you have a lot of these big VC-backed companies that have a lot of pressure on them to perform really well in the market and generate lots of revenue. And, you know, for whatever it's worth, there's been a lot, you know, being able to, or, you know, saying, making statements that something's like dangerous or is potentially misaligned, that captures everyone's attention. That's why do you think all these sci-fi books are so popular? Like the Terminator series, like all these sci-fi novels, they're so entertaining because of the risk. I mean, The Matrix and like AI enslaving humanity and all of this. You know, there's the thing is, if you want attention, it sounds like, I think a lot of it just, and I think it's even probably well done as a marketing strategy, is pretty successful.
Mm-hmm.
So like you have that in mind,
Right.
And a lot of people, I mean, this is not really my opinion. You know, you see a lot of people calling out this whole, and Andrew Ng, if you follow Andrew Ng on LinkedIn, he has a bunch of posts about this. But essentially, if you make all these claims about how your AI is so dangerous or it can blackmail users or all of these things, then it's you get in the headlines, you get more users, like it's fantastic marketing. But then from a regulatory perspective, it gives a lot of material to especially people who aren't following and aren't aware of how the technology works, a lot of cause for concern. And, you know, you can't really even blame them, to be honest. And so, and, you know, we're in the, you know, everyone's talking about the IPOs. We just had the SpaceX IPO. Now we have the, you know, Anthropic has filed, OpenAI has filed for IPO. So I think, you know, there's just a lot. It's like a, it's like the surface is starting to boil.
Right.
Maybe with excitement, maybe with these high valuations. And so I mean, I haven't looked like too deeply into it. And then, well, yeah, I know you have really good things to say. But I felt the safeguards were, I don't think I tested Fable as much as you did, but, you know, I didn't think it was, the safeguards were like too weak necessarily, other things. But I, maybe it's a delicate thing. So.
Yeah. I mean, it clearly is. But so do you think there, do you think there is a real danger there, or is it that it's a combination of marketing and the government not knowing how to assess it, but that it's actually not dangerous enough that it is worthy of that kind of restriction? Or do you think there is this potential danger where it, where these models should be locked down?
So I think that the risk is 100% real. Nothing that they're saying is fake or like a lie. It is a huge cybersecurity risk. I would say not just this model, but all the models that we currently have on the market are capable of like really, really destroying like people's lives. Like I give you an example, is cyberbullying is a huge problem. So what if I can just like get 24 like sophisticated models to just create Twitter accounts and to just sit there cyberbullying you, right? This is now scaled this up. And there are papers, research papers about Russia and how they use these like bot farms. So that they have these like buildings in their country. Like this is all public knowledge. And I don't think it was reported by the US even. It was reported in Russia. So they have these buildings, they pay people. Each person has to like operate 20 accounts. They have to have like a few main accounts and then a bunch of support characters, right? And they have to post every day like pictures. So they usually find like resources where there's like a single person that's not really famous that has a bunch of pictures online. They take those and they use those to like build up like over a year or two the these personas, these characters. If you go on Twitter and you look at anything Ukraine and Russia related, go into the comments, you're going to see all of these accounts that are like American, red-blooded American, you know, like if you go on their profiles, like fishing and like the US flag and Texan. But if you look at like the username of the account, you're going to see that it ends with like a bunch of random numbers. And if you start scrolling, you see, oh, it was made in February 2022. It was made in March 2022. So they use these as a way to control the narrative. And obviously we do the same thing. Every country does the same thing, right? It's reported that Israel does the same thing. I'm not like singling out Russia or anybody or us. So this is like the old world. This is the old version of this technology. So now with these models, like the more sophisticated the model, not only can it actually like manipulate public perception, but it could also try to hack people. It could try to spam like websites to get them taken down, right? Denial of service attacks. It could chain all of these vulnerabilities together. Then if you even take a step back from there and you look at, so there's theories about the COVID-19 being made in a lab, and the theory, and this is like also there is research about this. I'm not saying it's true or not, but it sounds plausible where you take a virus that is not necessarily that dangerous, and then you try to basically stimulate it to become much more dangerous. You basically iterate on like thousands of generations of this virus, like prodding it in certain ways. And then you can get that final result, like this really deadly variant, and you can figure out how to make a vaccine for it, right? So the idea is that, you know, this is probably going to happen anyway. Mm-hmm. So we need to build it out and we need to figure out how to use it to extract like cures for these diseases. So I don't think that the risks they're talking about are false. Mm-hmm. So putting that aside is like, there's two possibilities for me. Mm-hmm. Possibility one is that they are trying to shift perception of them from a SaaS company to a weapons manufacturer to a national security company. And it would be much easier to raise $1 trillion. So if you think about like Boeing, and we have a lot of American companies that are very high up that are weapons manufacturers, it's an easier sell. It's an easier sell for the government if you have a government contract. So Tesla was able to get, SpaceX, mm-hmm. was able to raise $1.75 trillion, right? What is Tesla doing? It's working with the government. It's building these space programs. It's helping with ballistic missiles. Like, you know, there's a whole bunch of things SpaceX does that is valuable, of course. But because they're so enmeshed with the government, so enmeshed with security, it's very easy for them to go and raise the largest amount of money ever, even though they don't have revenue or their revenue is not enough to cover their costs, whatever it is. So that's one possibility, is that this is like orchestrated, obviously orchestrated with the government. We know that this administration is like very happy to let you do whatever you want and help you as long as there is going to be financial gain. So you can imagine a world where they are working with Elon, mm-hmm. because they're using their data centers. If mm-hmm. you don't know, so they are using Colossus 1 or 2. I don't remember, one of the two. So they're using 33% of Elon's compute.
Anthropic.
Yes. So the models are hosted in Elon's data centers, mm-hmm. right? Elon is enmeshed in the government. And they can like play this up. They can write a percentage of the company to the people involved and they can get the narrative and get the money. Mm-hmm. Now, what would make this more plausible to me? I'm not saying this is the case. I've met with a lot of Anthropic people and they're really nice people. Like, you know, the people I have met are really great people. There's like families, you know, they have their own families. They're very nice. They, you know, they try to help, right? So I'm not saying like this company is like evil or whatever, but if the model releases today, mm-hmm. after GPT 5.6, mm-hmm. I will say this is like the more likely mm-hmm. scenario, right?
It's coordinated.
Yes, it's coordinated and they're just trying to like dominate as much as possible before the IPO. The second, I think plausible theory is that the people that are in charge or were in charge of communications, mm-hmm. One, they've been like selling this fear-mongering stuff. Mm-hmm. It's becoming more popular for people to have political opinions about data centers, about AI, right? Like it's becoming popular to hate on this stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and then the guy himself, like Dario, is not a normal public speaker. Right. He doesn't like the average person doesn't understand what this guy's saying.
Right.
It's like, you know, not that he's super smart. He's just not good at talking.
Well, the one thing they're getting is that the world's ending. And if we build this AI, there's, you know, a 30% chance that it's an apocalypse.
Yes.
And
we're going to take your jobs.
Right.
There's not going to be software engineers. There's not going to be this. There's not going to be that. So I think there's like a, you know, I think that could be backlash against this. I think it's one of these two. But the risks are real. Like we haven't as a society at all figured out what to do about this.
So if the risks are real, do you think these models should be restricted? Or do you think, you know, should that extend into open weight? Like if tomorrow, you know, GLM 5.3 comes out and it's a Mythos class model, how do you think the government should respond?
So personally, I just want freedom. That's really like my core belief system. I have kids now. So if I'm starting to think about like, okay, there's myself and what I want total freedom, right? Even if it's a weapon, I should be able to own it. This is the American like way of life. I believe, you know, like the freedom to bear arms. I think probably the best shot we have is framing AI not as freedom of speech, but as freedom to bear arms. I think that's probably like the political way that we get to keep local models, that we get to keep hardware. it's because we, you know, this should be a human right to protect ourselves, to help ourselves, to build our fortresses, right? And but if I look at like then my kid doesn't have the time to like, he's still a kid, right? And my daughter's still a kid. They don't really know, like, should there be no jobs? Are we politically prepared for there to not be jobs? Like, you know, if 30% of the population that lives off of public transportation in the United States, 30% of the population, if they get replaced by these autonomous vehicles. So first, you have the truck drivers, the Uber drivers, the delivery drivers, all these people. They're not making money. Their families then aren't making money. They can't go to the zoo. They can't go to the park. They can't, like, you know, the income dries up. And so it starts to, like, really deteriorate society. And we haven't even started to consider, like, these real things as opposed to, like, you know, the worst case scenario, AI takes over the world type thing. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, completely. Yeah, I mean, there's all these different dimensions to the risk. You know, there's the cybersecurity risk. There's how it's going to impact the economy, how it's going to impact society. So there's all these different layers. But I do wonder, you know, if I kind of suspect that, at least with this current class of models, that on balance, it helps defenders more than attackers. Because yes, it enables people to attack, but I think most of the people using these models are not trying to attack, mm-hmm. are not trying to hack, are not trying to build bioweapons. They're the kind of reasonable, rational people that want what's good for society. And it empowers those people as well, including the people who are trying to figure out how to defend against these risks.
Let me give you a real world example from my time in crypto. So one thing I was building was software that would prevent so on the Ethereum blockchain, they're called, there are these, it's been a while, but they are people that just sit on top of the blockchain. They have a bot that sits on the blockchain and they scan every single transaction. And then they, so it's called MEV, M-E-V, minor extracted value. So they have a node set up and they can, like, look at all the transactions. They can find profitable transactions. So basically a transaction where there is a contract that has an open method where somebody can put data in and then get paid out. So there are a whole bunch of these contracts, right? Because blockchains are stateless. Like they don't know, they cannot reach out. So somebody has to go and inject the state into the system. So you have to keep that open so it's incentivized. But then these bots, they'll just sit there. They'll see you submitted a transaction to the mining pool. Mm-hmm. They'll replace your address with their address, increase the tip price, mm-hmm. and then their transaction wins and they get the profit, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not about like the majority of the population going rogue and like trying to hack each other because something's there that makes it possible to do so. It's that there are people who, let's say, amoral, that just want to make a profit. And an example on code is, imagine you have the Linux kernel repo and you have a pull request, because what they do is they'll have one pull request and then other pull requests merge into it. So you can scan all of those before it's merged. You can basically analyze to see if any of them are security fixes. Because what happens when you report a bug to the Linux Foundation, they will then basically have like a month to go and merge this in before you, the reporter, are allowed to make this public. But now there isn't that window, right? Because the models can scan it. Even if you try to like hide it, even if you try to like make it look like it's part of another PR, they can scan it, find it, and execute on it before it's merged. And even after it's merged, like it gets merged into the Linux kernel. Like all of these like Ubuntu, and like it takes time for them to implement that. So you have like these floating, CVs all over the place, mm-hmm. and the models are capable of executing on it. The current state of models, they are capable of executing on it, but you have to kind of like set up an environment for them and like, you know, like spend a lot of time monitoring them. As the models get more intelligent, they're just able to like deal with it themselves, right? They don't need any help.
Right. But I mean, and that makes sense in the short term, but I wonder in the medium term if that leads to the most secure software in the world, because if everybody has access to, you know, an unrestricted Mythos, and yeah, there'll be all these attacks, but eventually every developer will get used to you know, if I'm opening a PR, do a security review by Mythos, or if I have a code base, do a security audit. And I guess there's kind of a theoretical question of like, how secure can software be made? Like, is there sort of inherent plateau where no matter how many Mythos reviews you do, there's always going to be a way in? But if it's kind of, if there is some kind of bar that you can hit where you can raise the cost of attack, where if I have Mythos and you have Mythos, that I can use it to create sufficiently secure software where it's, even if you have the same AI, it's going to be too expensive or uneconomical to attack. We don't really know. But I guess one thing I worry about with the incentives here is the true fear of the government that Mythos will make software too insecure, or is the real fear that it'll make software too secure?
Mm-hmm.
Because who has the best hackers in the world? Who has the most zero days in the world? The US government. So if we imagine a world where Mythos patched every security flaw in every software in the world, maybe that's not a world that the NSA wants, because now they're locked out. And so there's a perverse incentive that we've seen throughout the decades as we've slipped into mass surveillance and the Snowden revelations, that parts of the US government have an interest in insecure information infrastructure so that they can ride alongside that they can gather the data. And so that, you know, perhaps is kind of a hidden dynamic in all of these safety restrictions, is that there's actually a danger in their eyes of there being too much safety.
What do you think of this?
I mean, could be crazy conspiracy.
Yeah.
Theory. I'm not saying
this. No. I mean, I think, I mean, I will say this. So my time, you know, my time adjacent, I was never really in this world. I was, you know, I worked as a defense contractor doing basic academic research, same kind of research you do as like a professor or something. All public and everything, or all publishable. And, you know, just all my interactions were that, like, people sometimes think of the government as like this entity, but it's just regular people. And most people care a lot. And actually, I think a lot of people in government care even more than a lot of, like it's some kind of like service, or they're like, they feel some like national pride. And they're doing something for their country and their fellow citizens. And like, you know, I think there's a lot of people that care a lot, actually, in the government. And the government is mostly made up of those people. What I think is interesting is incentives get around that. And behavior at a system level or an institutional level often gets around individual, can override like individual you know, desires for like good and all this. And I think you have this with anything, with any company, with any institution, you have to be very careful with like the incentives. And so this is all just to say, like, this is the, like, it's almost like, and then I think about if the laws are the soft, Elon said this once a long time ago, that like laws are the software of society. And so then I just think like, we just don't have enough, or maybe not the right software for society, which in some ways like provides some checks or gives rights to people or helps balance incentives at the system level. And so it's really this question of like, how do you solve these like system level, like what are the right systems and the right like laws and software? And the reality is like, it's like everything you just said is so entertaining, but like, I feel like I don't even know 1% of what's really going on. You
right.
Know?
I mean, we can only speculate. And I think, I mean, I agree with you about the motivations. You know, I think even this, let's say this theory is true, I think the people who are pursuing that are coming from good intentions, what they think is right. It's not like it's some evil purpose to sort of, you know, unjustly oppress people, but that if you, and also the government isn't monolithic, like there's different factions, there's tensions within it, people have conflicting perspectives. But if you are, you know, working on the, if you're a hacker at the NSA who has this library of 0 days, or you're working on mass surveillance, or you're working on all these things, like there's a genuine concern about needing these capabilities to defend against terrorism or defend against all these threats. And so it's not that there's like good guys and bad guys, but that there's a conflict of values or judgment about what is the right thing. And, you know, this is a classic trade-off that goes, you know, to the founding of the US and before, you know, the trade-off between freedom and security. You know, if you want maximum security, get rid of the Bill of Rights. That's just an impediment to law enforcement. You know, why should they need a warrant? You know, why should there be any restrictions? You know, it's all dual use. Like when we talk about with AI as dual use, human rights are dual use. A pencil is dual use. A library is dual use. You know, intelligence itself, whether artificial or natural, is dual use. So that's part of what makes this so difficult, is that there's a genuine trade-off that needs to be made. There's not just some magic option that we can pull where there's no risks, there's no harms. There's risks either way, whether we make it too restrictive or not restrictive enough.
I think our problem right now is that the majority of the government, like the people making these final decisions, right? Like the top players, I'm not talking about like the people working in the DMV, the people working in public healthcare. The people that are making these decisions are like these mimetic characters, right? So if you think about Alexandria Cortez or Bernie Sanders or even Trump, you know, and his, these people, like they have to be memes in order to get that far in. They have to be super simple, super basic, like in their opinions, the outward opinions. I'm not talking about like their internal, you know, what's going on in their mind. So what happens then is like you don't have adults in the room that can make real decisions, right? Like the decisions that need to be made aren't like ban this thing or, you know, let everybody access this thing. The decisions that need to be made are like, okay, what is the safety profile of the technology of this country? Like how safe are we from external attack? How much of our grid could be accessed publicly, right? If somebody has like a computer, goes sits under some building, can they get into the electrical grid? Which is like a real, real concern, right? The entire electrical grid is running on code. Somebody can go in and like mess with it. And this has happened, and this is happening in places like Ukraine, where whenever they want to like make a big push, they'll have people go in and hack these electrical companies and like shut stuff off so that people have to move, right? So this is the kind of stuff that we need to like think about, which is much, much, much different than somebody has a like an AI that can like hack into some website on the internet that isn't really important. It's like this national security stuff. It's this economic stuff, right? And it's also like the educational stuff, like, do we bring the AI into the schools? And if we do, what's going to happen? Like, do we even have any idea of what's going to happen? Because we haven't tried this. Everybody's already using it. So like, it's the standard that nobody is like addressing in any meaningful adult way. This is how I feel about it. I'm really disappointed in how this, specifically this country, deals with like the law. And like, it just feels to me like a social media, like clout, you know, machine, right? It's just like everybody's arguing to get attention as right. opposed to like do the right thing.
Well, and then what I feel about that is I feel like social media is like, that's the most public, but it feels like 0.5% maybe of like how everyone feels. Like most people I know are not really on social media, or they don't post, they just lurk. And so you've got this tiny fraction of people on social media, and that's what everyone's consuming, but yet it's not how everyone feels, and it's not even representative of everyone. And as soon as you go out into this, like you go to like a bar, or you go to a restaurant, or you go out with some friends, or you go to a club, and then you talk to people, and it's like
night and day difference. It's not really the same. I mean, two things kind of came up for me. Is one is recently, like in the last 6 months, I've read two Neal Stephenson sci-fi books, Snow Crash and The Diamond Age. And have you guys read either of those?
I haven't, but I've heard they're great.
So in both of them, the future he paints is much more kind of like tribal, mm-hmm. in that like there's even sections of the United States that are like corporations kind of run and control those territories. And then even in Diamond Age, a lot of Diamond Age is like around like nanotechnology. And it's almost like individuals and these tribes, like everyone has kind of like these like layers of defenses. So one thing that comes back is waiting rooms in people's houses, because when you're going to go visit someone's home, you sit in the waiting room and all of their nano tech, like little bots or mites in the waiting room, scan you, like scan your whole body and your whole system to see if there's any threatening thing in there. And some people almost walk around with like clouds of these nanobots like around them, that kind of serve as a defense. And then there's even these like walls of nanobots literally between the territories. And so, and this is a question I wanted to ask you, because you know for sure some of these dangers with like AI are real. And I wonder, and especially with like no adults being in the room and people not, it's like it feels more than ever like your responsibility as an individual to like get up to speed as much as you can. And you have AI to help you, which is amazing. So it's been easier than ever, but it still obviously requires like time and resource. But I guess like, we've said this on a previous podcast where I feel like even going on social media directly is, you know, kind of a, you know, it like messes with your mind. Like I see these posts and it's because some of these posts are meant to like capture your attention and get you to focus on something and care about something. And the way that they do that is they like try to invoke FOMO, or they try to invoke fear, or they try to invoke like all of these things. But like you're a human being in this body with this nervous system, you pay a tax every time you consume that. And so going on it directly, now you could be like, oh, let's see what's happening in the world. And maybe you're now 5% less productive, or you get tired earlier in the day because you've been consuming this. So this thing is like, so, you know, and this, and I want to get into this part. We can do it later too. I don't want to go back to some of the topics, but right. I've been setting up my, because of your talk last week, I started setting up my own Hermes like assistant running on, you know, a combination of like some cloud big frontier models, but also mostly this like local Qwen, which is unbelievably good. But the thing is like, I almost feel like this is becoming my own little personal defense agent.
Right.
And it's like, I'm curious if you guys have thoughts for like the practical, like someone listening to the show, what steps could they take, or should they start thinking about to like use agents to maybe defend or help them think better or think clearly or be less influenced, and whatever they feel about how they want our society to be like, and, you know, even things like voting, you know, it's always bothered me that no one votes and that voting percentages are so low and people are so demotivated to vote. I wonder if it's mostly like an information and effort issue. If you could have this AI that's always running, it understands you, it's fiduciary, could that ensure like more people are voting and more people's voices are heard? And then the society reflects more of what like everyone wants in it rather than a smaller group of people. So, but I guess, sorry, that was a lot there, but great. I guess really the any practical things you guys have thought about for on the defense side?
Maybe you can go.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're still very early on in what's happening here. So I think the most important thing for people to do is to, start running, like getting hardware, running open weight models, open source systems, learning how to use it, taking control, taking ownership. Because I think this is becoming the preeminent form of power in the world. Knowledge is power. These systems, your ability to, you know, not only just use social media without feeling bad, but your perception of reality itself is shaped by social media and what you think is true or false. Like, even if you're voting, if you've been propagandized and your whole perception of reality is warped, then your vote has effectively been taken from you by whoever's manipulating you or controlling you. So as we move into this kind of hyper AI age, if you want to have freedom, autonomy, privacy, self-determination, freedom of speech, you're going to need your own sovereign AI that you control, that you use to navigate this world. And that's what concerns me about this bigger picture stuff, is that we've seen this pattern throughout history where there's like a small elite who believe that only they can have the power and it wouldn't be safe for most people to have it. And so, you know, whether that is like the king and the nobility, you know, and the aristocracy, or whether that's like in the time of the Gutenberg printing press where only the priests could read the Bible because it was in Latin. And, you know, if the common person has access to an English translation of the Bible, they'll get like the devil's thoughts in their heads. There's usually this tension in society where the people who have the power convince themselves that they should have that power, that they should be the only ones to have that power. And even, you know, they think it's for the good or they think it's for safety, but because there's a potential bias there, it's not necessarily accurate. And it oftentimes is more safe for there to be a balance of power, not concentration of power, not centralization of power, but a balance of a power, decentralized power, because power corrupts. And so no matter how good you are or how wise you are, if you have too much of it, it's going to corrupt you. You aren't going to be able to use it for good things. And so what is playing out now, where on the one hand, we have this very legitimate safety debate, but on the other hand, it's creating a power structure where you have an elite group of companies that have access to the Mythos model, or, you know, the governments have access to the most
powerful. Or the American people.
But is that like the restrictions to giving it to the American people or giving it to the people of the
world? Well, imagine we get it, but they're not. Like, the rest of the world won't. So we will get it. This is going to happen. We're going to get good usage limits because we're the only ones using it. And so the idea here is that America remains the most intelligent country, because if you can like augment your intelligence with this thing, maybe we can end on this. I didn't mean to interrupt
point. Yeah.
So I think there's like practical advice on like how I'm doing this course here in San Francisco, is like how to AI your life. So you have like all of these different sources of information, like think your email, your Twitter, whatever, all like your Discord, your job, your calendar. All of that can be wired into a harness that, and a model can then read that and then decide like how to format your day, how to like figure out your taxes, how to, because this is, I do my taxes with AI now, and like I am not great at that. I would like probably not do it well, but I can get this model, I can wire it in, like look at all my receipts, invoices, you know, and get me my tax return for 2026, 2025, whatever, in multiple countries. Like I was getting a visa to Japan, like, hey, go figure out what I need to do. Cause it's like, it's pretty, like you have to have like specific licenses for certain medications to get into the country. You know, you need like, you need a phone, you need internet, you need the Suica card. There's a whole bunch of stuff that I wouldn't know by myself that an AI is able to help me figure out. So I think like from the perspective of a person who wants to improve their life, like one is use the hardware that you have. Then if you need more, buy more if you can. If you can't, like figure out how to make do with what you have. A surprising thing is a very, very big company that I work with, their number one most used model is Llama 3.18B. Because it's fast and it's cheap and they can just do mass tagging, mass data analysis, filtering, all this stuff can be done with like a dumb model, right? You know, relatively intelligent for the size of it. So yeah, I think people need to like figure out, in my opinion, they need to figure out like where they stand in all this, because you know, there are the people that are going to have it, the people that are using it, and they're going to say this is the most amazing thing, and like, you know, a permanent underclass, all that. And then there's the people that don't have it, don't know how to do it, or have to be given like license to use it, right? And those people are going to be behind. There's no but about it. Like, if the model can do pretty much anything, you have to have the model, right? To be the smartest person. So again, America, we're going to get Fable. Other countries won't for a while. Maybe someone else releases something, and you know, maybe it spreads afterwards. There's that. And then what you were saying about like power and corruption. So I read two books that I find very, very like true. One is Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. Mm-hmm. And the other one, well, let's start with that. So with Crime and Punishment, there's this guy who goes to university. His family's very poor, and they're sending him their money to go to university. And he's like basically humiliated from this process of like taking money from his sister and so he can study law. And eventually he gets it in his mind that if he is truly going to be elite, that he needs to be able to do whatever it takes to keep going. So he decides to go to this lady, which is a pawn shop keeper, and he murders her and steals all the gold. This was in St. Petersburg. And then the lady's sister comes in, and she has like some mental disability, and she sees him, and he kills her too, even though he didn't intend to. And he ran away. He managed to get out. He didn't like get caught. And even though there were multiple times where he would almost get caught, but when he would go to sleep, he would be sweating. He would be having fever dreams. He would be like hallucinating. He couldn't like live. He was just like, there's a mental tax of like, you know, you did something wrong. Even if you don't believe, if you don't fully 100% believe that it is the right thing to do, you are going to suffer. So the punishment there is like, it doesn't matter if you're free or not, you're still being punished by your conscience. The other one is called The Will to Power by Nietzsche. So Nietzsche's like argument is that there are people out there that they want power, and it doesn't matter like the morality or the ethics, and maybe the moral thing is to get the power regardless of the cost, because then you can shape the world in your image. Maybe your image is better, right? So there are people that believe this. I personally don't. I feel like everybody's like, you know, everybody has potential. I was in a really bad situation in my younger years. But you have potential. People can help you. You know, you can improve. Maybe there's a little bit of intelligence difference between people, but I really don't think that is relevant. So I think more people have to have the mindset of the will to power to equal it out, right? Because if there's only like 100 people in this country that decided like, I will get power no matter what, then we have this like, literal slavery in this country. Medical, if you want a medical, if you want medical care, either you have to work for a company, or you have to like basically not have a job and get it from the government, and you can't make a certain amount per month. That's the same that's going to happen to AI if people don't like really push. We're going to have licenses that are given to you by your employer or by your government, right? And they're going to see everything that you talk about, everything that you try to do. If you ever try to ascend, they can shoot you down, right? Like if you ever try to push too hard, they know what's going on. So like we should understand like more people need to have this will to power and like, you know, balance it maybe with some good morality. Because if not, we're just going to keep being led.
Yeah. I love that. I think that's very powerfully said. And I think that really highlights the importance of what's happening with open source AI and the importance of the work that you're doing, because this is the only hope we have to have to maintain a free society where we don't become enslaved.
We need to diffuse intelligence everywhere. Everyone needs to have it on their computer. Everyone needs to use it. Everyone needs to understand it and contribute to it. And, you know, when the internet started, like one of the major reasons why we have media and podcasting and recording is because of pornography. People wanted to see pornography. And it was very hard to do because like images are a lot of data, right? And the old internet couldn't handle that. It was old dial-up. So people had to invent all these compression methods like JPEG and like whatever. There's a whole bunch of them. So people had to like invent these methods of like compression, transportation, you know, cheaper hosting. FFmpeg is like a compression algorithm, right? It's at every frame, it's pulling in things and it's trying to figure out the smartest way to pull the next frame without costing you you know, your computer would not be able to run videos without this stuff. So like we need this. I really do think so. If only to learn about it, man. This is like a huge economic opportunity, right? This is clearly the next wave of technology. So if you learn how to do this stuff, you are instantly much, much more valuable.
Yeah, absolutely. I read even one of the first uses of the Gutenberg printing press was pornography. So for some reason, it just kind of goes hand in hand with information revolutions, I guess.
Whatever makes human life easier.
Yeah, exactly. It's a powerful motivation. Awesome. Well, maybe that's a good place to wrap for today. Any thoughts?
Well, I just definitely want to say, if people want to follow you, where's a good place to find you online?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter. GitHub and Hugging Face, I think, are like the three. YouTube also. It's 0xsero. That's it.
Awesome. And then just, this is personally motivated, but maybe some listeners care too. Do you have any estimated time when local.ai will be?
Yeah, I think we resumed the benchmarking. We had to pause. The people went on vacation, like the tech people. But we restarted, I think, earlier this week. I'm pretty sure we'll be done with it like in the next few weeks. I'll get you the link so you can like use it. But
I'm one of the elites right now.
Well, I don't want to give people false information.
No, of course. I'd be happy to play with it and look at it.
Yeah. Thank you guys for having me. It's a great.
Yeah.
Great
thank
space.
You so much for having me, having us and joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks to the audience for joining us for another episode of Decentralized AI. If you like this episode, please like and subscribe and chime in the comments and let us know what you think about these very important issues. And we'll see you next time.
See you next time.
See you next time.